Hi,
this is Take Charge Your Health with Corinne Fornari, clinical nutritionist, clinician assistant, and Carol Peterson, pharmacist.
Listen, learn, and I hope you enjoy the show. Bye.
Welcome back. This is Take Charge of Your Health with Corinne Fornari, clinical nutritionist and physician assistant, and my co-host, Carol Peterson, pharmacist. Every week, we present you with new and creative ways to help you make sense of health information. With years of clinical experience between us and research into traditional and cutting-edge technologies, we give you practical information to help you take charge of your health. Welcome back, welcome back. I'm here today with my co-host,
Carol Peterson.
And you're going to have to pay attention because we are going through fast and furiously some very important information that can really help you in your daily lives. The understanding as well as the actual implementation at the end will be very important to you. So I'd like to start out. Carol's going to explain to us about some new FDA rules in regards to that toxic metal, mercury.
I'm really excited about this. This was issued on September 24th, 2020, from the FDA, and it's recommending that you do not use mercury amalgam in your mouth. Those are the silver fillings. About 50% of those fillings are elemental mercury.
Wow.
There are other metals mixed in there. So it's something everybody should be aware of. And you already know the mercury thermometers are considered too dangerous. What about in your mouth?
Now, this has been legislated and worked on in Europe. In Germany, they stopped amalgams. In Canada, they put a limit on amalgams. So now this is the first time we're hearing about it from the FDA. Go on, Carol.
There was some earlier things, but not with the teeth and the categories that they're saying now. So pregnant women and developing babies should not have a mercury filling place.
It's about time.
Any women who want to become pregnant, nursing moms and their babies, children under six. However, children really can't include anybody under the age of 18. Anybody with a neurological condition of any sort. Anybody with impaired kidney function, because your body has to struggle to get rid of this stuff. Anybody with a heightened sensitivity, and there are tests that show this. If you go to some doctors, they can test for allergy to mercury and to the other heavy metals in the mercury amalgam. So they also warn that if you are having a heavy mercury burden from eating fish, or there's toxicity in your water, it's another reason not to increase the load of this mercury. So I was actually involved in this in a small way, albeit the FDA had a hearing on this. I didn't attend, but I was able to contribute an article, and it was read into the record by Charlie Brown, who's been the spearhead of this movement to try to stop poisoning by mercury amalgam. We already know that mercury leaches from the amalgams. One of the interesting things is it's there in your mouth, in your head, and there's nervous system network. So through your nervous system tissue, you can actually shuttle mercury from your mercury amalgams into your head, and you have some very important endocrine organs there. You have your pituitary gland, your hypothalamus that gives signaling to your thyroid, your sex organs, your adrenal organs. So there's some interference there. Heavy metals can be estrogenic in activity. It will sit in estrogen receptors and act like an estrogen. In the literature that progesterone receptors are blocked by mercury. So you have this interference at the receptor site with heavy metals. And we have hormone dysfunction, but a lot of people have not gone so far as to go to the root cause, like what is going on. So the evidence of mercury in your mouth should, for everybody who sees a doctor about hormone problems, that should be addressed. Are there mercury amalgam in your mouth? And how soon can you get it out safely would be a big issue.
Dr. Shade said that if you see a lack of conversion of the thyroid hormone, and the thyroid makes lots of T4 and a little bit of T3 and then converts the T4 to T3. If you see that conversion being blocked, that's a mercury blockage. So your thyroid isn't working correctly because of mercury, but also mercury accumulates in the thyroid gland.
It accumulates in your nervous system tissue all over your body. So this is quite the landmark thing. We've been working on the FDA to do something about this really unsafe practice. And it's been going on for 150 years. People are not being told about the dangers. And even the FDA ruling, did that make the headlines in the newspapers all over the place? It did not. So I think it's important that we bring this awareness to our listening audience so they can start asking questions.
So what we've done is we've brought a wonderful dentist here to speak with us about teeth health and how he deals with the amalgam problem and situation and creating healthy teeth. And we're going to continue this conversation. We're going to speak with a dentist, a colleague of Carol's, and look at some of the inside insights onto mercury and why it's still being used in the dental industry or the dental profession. Carol, could you introduce Dr. Hans Schwartz to us, please?
Yes, thank you, Corinne. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Hans-Jürgen Schwartz. He's been a personal friend for more than 20 years, but I met him at a epiphany point of his career. He suddenly found out about the toxicity of mercury in the mouth and shook him to his very core, and now practices as a mercury-free dentist. So Dr. Schwartz has had 30 years experience as a dentist. Prior to that, he did 10 years of medical research. He graduated, his undergrad is from the University of California at Berkeley. Then he went on to McGill University in Montreal to do research, and finally ending up doing research and getting his degree in dentistry at the University of Toronto. So welcome to our show, Dr. Schwartz. We're so delighted to have you
welcome
today.
Thank you, Carol.
I'd like to start out with what Corinne just hinted at. Mercury amalgam is made up of a composite of metals. It's not just mercury. And for many years, the dental industry just called them silver. There is some silver in there, too, with an intent, I believe, to really confuse the public as to what is actually in that substance. So we have for decades now, it's like 150 years, this mercury amalgam composite material has been used to fill teeth. Now, given that they are, number one, cosmetically pretty ugly, why do you suppose the dental industry hangs on to using and teaching still dentists and student dentists how to put mercury in the mouth? So take it away, Dr. Schwartz. Love to hear what you have to say.
Okay, I think that mercury fillings were quick and dirty and easy to do. They tended to last fairly well, even though they damaged the teeth. And it's just been traditionally used for all this time. And there's the old guard that, of course, sticks to it and doesn't want to move from it. It took quite a while for any other materials to be accepted. And some of the other materials, too, have their own problems. But basically, I think it's just they're not listening to the information as it was coming in about the toxicity of mercury to the human body.
Dr. Schwartz, what created your epiphany? Why did you change at the point you did? And this was quite a few years ago before this was a very well-known issue.
Yeah. Well, I was doing research in immunopathology, and it finally occurred to me why, you know, as I was a student studying this stuff, why are we using mercury in this material, you know, because it's a known toxin and more toxic than any non-radioactive material on the planet. Yet it was convenient and quick and dirty and just became practice. Finally, I realized I don't want to be involved in this stuff anymore. And I looked for alternatives and found them and have been doing things differently since then. In fact, I avoid metal as much as possible in doing dentistry.
Well, let's talk about some of the points you and I discussed yesterday after I visited your dental chair. So one of the things that you told me was how the non-mercury amalgams are being placed, and then there's the situation of undercutting a tooth to place the mercury amalgam. Can you explain what actually happens when somebody gets an amalgam or the alternative materials placed in the mouth? How is this done?
Okay, certainly. With mercury amalgam, it has to be physically locked into the tooth because there's no bonding, no natural affinity between those two substances. So you have to remove more of the tooth structure to allow physical undercuts and bonding for this material to be held in place. With the newer materials, we can rely on bonding, such as the resins and other materials, where we etch the tooth surface and physically link the material to the tooth.
So there's less damage to the actual tooth when you're doing this sort of filling.
Exactly. Okay. We can bond directly to the surface of the tooth, you know, without having to undercut and lock the filling in physically.
Okay, so you cut away the decay, and that's all you do. With the mercury amalgam, if I understand correctly, you have to sacrifice a bigger part of the tooth.
Yes, you actually have to do that, unfortunately.
So how does that extra cutting affect the future of that tooth and your mouth health?
Well, the extra cutting makes the tooth more vulnerable to fracture. And you have, you know, the physical forces of chewing, which are pretty heavy, can help to break the tooth down when you weakened it by doing the undercuts in order to place the amalgams. Yeah, the resin materials are bonded to the surface, and the bond is quite strong, except that it can be broken down by acids, such as is found in plaque on the teeth. If the patient doesn't take really super good care, those materials are much more likely to fail and flake off the tooth.
Well, that's a good point. So to protect your bonded tooth with a resin material, it's absolutely essential that you practice good mouth hygiene so the plaque doesn't build up in the mouth.
What about
exactly?
What about vinegar or lemon? Would that interfere with the binding of
absolutely.
The resin?
Absolutely.
Oh, it will. Okay.
Absolutely.
How many?
You know, little by little.
He absolutely cringes if you want to suck on a lemon.
Well, you know, how many dentists, when you leave their office, tell you this after they place a resin filling? We're not really instructed on the care of these fillings. But I have another question in terms of mercury. So the mercury, 50% of the amalgam minimum, is in your mouth. Now, you're drinking hot, you're drinking cold, you're also eating vinegar and lemons. What does that do to the amalgam? What does that do to the mercury?
Well, the mercury that's there is there and present as a liquid and can come off as a vapor. So it's constantly, you're constantly losing mercury with the vapor that's coming off those fillings over many years even. And inhaling that stuff, it gets into your system and is very toxic to the body in general.
And now, then hot, cold, and what about how much you chew?
Well, exactly. It depends also on what you chew. Some foods are very hard. Some people also have habits where they're grinding, and that can cause other problems. The amalgam can be broken down just by biting hard on a material. So we have to make it fairly thick in order to resist that breakage that could occur just from chewing heavy, you know, solid food.
Well, I had heard that one of the problems with mercury amalgam is that it's harder than your surrounding tooth material. So if you bite down hard on something, it's the tooth that's actually vulnerable and not the filling. And that disparity in the hardness can cause some fracturing of your tooth.
Certainly, just by cutting the tooth to place the filling, you're creating potential fracture lines, which can lead to breakage and flaking, breaking away of tooth structure when you're chewing hard. And you're grinding side to side, so you're putting lateral forces on that can help break down the tooth as well as crack the fillings themselves, those amalgam fillings.
Now,
okay, I'd like to go back to the hot and cold question.
Yes, me too.
Thanks for anyway. We don't want to leave that behind. Because,
no, it's very important.
We drink hot coffee and ice cream.
Which we love, both of the above.
Yes. What's happening?
Yes, and the other thing is that hot and cold can cause expansion and contraction of the metal, which will exacerbate, you know, the problems that are associated with breakdown from hard chewing over time.
Okay, so that expansion and contraction can lead to more cracking. I'd like to also bring up the issue of the fact that this is indeed a metal. And metals are known to conduct electricity. So do we have electrical things going on in our mouth with silver fillings, mercury amalgam in our teeth?
Absolutely. And if you have other metals as well, there's similar metals used for crowns and other things, potentially there could be interaction between the different metals, you know, with currents that are probably stronger than the nervous system impulses, you know, in the oral environment. We don't know what that does.
Can we measure that?
Potentially, I think it could be. I don't know how much research has been done in that area per se, but definitely I would be suspicious that there could be. So I avoid metals as much as possible. You know, just for that reason, to avoid that possibility.
Now, there are two types of mercury. There's the methyl mercury and the inorganic mercury. the inorganic mercury is more toxic. The methyl mercury our body is able to handle better, but some people convert the methyl mercury at a higher rate to the inorganic. When we're talking about mercury in the teeth, what type of mercury are they using?
Well, it's inorganic, basically.
So it's the toxic form
metal
that your body can't break down.
Exactly. It can cross cell membranes. It can go through the body almost anywhere.
Uh-huh.
Whereas the methyl mercury might bond physically because of its charge.
Well, I'd like to bring up the issue that we used to have thermometers that had mercury in them, and we've pretty much made that illegal throughout the U.S. In fact, if you would have one of those old mercury thermometers and you broke it, you need to call in people with hazmat suits. So how do you justify, on one hand, the super consciousness about the toxicity of mercury from a thermometer, yet we haphazardly put this in people's mouths? How do you balance those two philosophies?
Yeah, I was always struck by that. It's not, there's a lot of things that aren't really very information that's very available to the average person, you know, behind all this stuff. So everything is pretty much controlled, you know, as the information comes out. And I think dentistry has had a privileged position in being able to perhaps not let some of that information become available to the public very easily.
In fact, hasn't the dental organization, through peer pressure, really, on dental boards, et cetera, have pretty much tried to gag dentists from giving people information about choices and relative toxicities? I recall several dentists getting suits brought before them because they dared to share this knowledge with their patients. I hope we've gone beyond that, but this was quite prevalent for quite a few years.
Not that long ago.
Yeah.
Now,
it's pretty scary, and I think that dentists have avoided these conflicts as much as they could.
Now there's mercury in a dentist's office. How do dentists deal with the outgassing in their own office? They're dealing with this every day or using it every day.
Yes, that is definitely a problem. When I do removal of these amalgams, we use the safe procedure, which helps to minimize, you know, the spread of this stuff into the room. We have a special high-volume suction over the patient's, in front of the patient's mouth, and we have high-volume suction on the tooth as we're removing it. And myself, I usually will remove one large one or two small ones once a month in order to keep to minimize the patient's exposure to this as well, because it's pretty hard to avoid exposure to the patient, even with rubber dams,
mm-hmm.
you know, which are not that necessary, you know, totally protect us.
Can you tell the audience, please, what a rubber dam is?
Yes, a rubber dam is a piece of flexible plastic that we, for the teeth that we're working on, we cut a hole in the dam and we pull it over those teeth so that they protrude through, and we have the dam collecting a lot of the debris as we're removing the filling material. So if you're doing a lot of work at once on a patient, it's best to protect them with the dam so that they minimize their own absorption of any spill. The less you do, if you do one tooth, you're going to minimize that exposure greatly to the patient.
Now, before, I would like to go into why is this important to the individual patient, but before that, I'd like to speak with you while we have you on the air. A quick and focused relationship. How do we care for our teeth? Where are all these cavities and cavitations coming from? Can you explain that to us? How can we teach our kids better methods of caring for our teeth?
Well, that's a difficult one because parents are very permissive with their children and allow them food that's, you know, that can attack the teeth. You know, a lot of frequent food with much sugar and acids will certainly attack the tooth surface and lead to the development of cavities. So, you know, I sometimes see children as young as 4 years of age that already have established cavities on teeth that have only been in their mouth for a year or so.
Oh my goodness.
It's quite shocking.
Yeah,
I see other patients that have absolutely perfectly healthy-looking teeth, and they have not been exposed to that environment. They've been, the parents have taken, you know, more care to prevent availability of all those kinds of food materials and other things, sugars, to the child.
I've seen soda pops in bottles being given to little kids.
Sure.
So for those kids, how would I teach care of the teeth after dietary care, which becomes my, as an adult, responsibility?
Well, it's just hard. You have to, you know, be very consistent and influence the child to want to have good, healthy teeth and know the relationship between, you know, the poor choices that they might make that lead to cavities down the road. And, of course, the profession uses fluoride as part of that also.
Oh, my goodness, we forgot to ask about that.
There's another controversy.
Oh, yeah.
And what do you think about it?
Well, I'm not very much into doing a lot of fluoride. You know, it's of course considered very important, and we are told we have to, you know, do this. And it's still a very controversial area because fluoride has a toxicity. It may even interfere with iodine being available to the thyroid because it's a halogen. It's a huge can of worms that I try to stay away from personally just to protect myself.
You recommend brushing and flossing or dental picks?
Absolutely.
What do you recommend?
Yeah, avoid, first of all, the materials that cause the problem, but secondly, to be sure that you learn how to brush well, how to floss, how to use picks and other devices to remove things. But it's been considered that children under the age of 10 don't have quite the manual dexterity either, and they sometimes need help with a parent assisting in doing this for them and showing them how to do this, you know, effectively.
What's the best kind of toothbrush?
I like to use a softer brush that's more flexible, and also there are brush heads that have different amounts of bristles. Sometimes I use an end-tuft brush, which has a circle of small bristles so that you can get in between teeth better and behind the teeth at the back of the mouth. That's very effective in removing, you know, material that otherwise with a big brush head, the bristles might not reach there.
Okay, I want to give you a zinger here. So how far are we away from creating, say, with stem cells, an organ replacement where the organ is the tooth?
Okay, yes, that's an interesting concept. And some of the research I did was also involving stem cells. But it's very difficult to grow teeth because they're complicated. There are two layers. The germ layers in a tooth. There's the enamel, which is formed separately from the rest of the tooth. And so that makes it more challenging to use stem cells to form a tooth that would be accepted by the body if it's introduced. So that's a very complicated area. I don't know how much, you know, what kind of results they've had recently with that. I haven't looked into that lately.
So, do you think in our lifetime?
Possibly, but I really think that it would be more effective to just
Take care of your teeth.
Good diet and
take care of your diet. Right? Okay, Dr. Schwartz, you have been delightful to come talk with us today and answer some of our questions. I think this is an area that people don't get to know very much about. You go to the dentist and you just sit there and really let them do whatever they think is best without a good idea of the mechanics and the materials and the philosophy behind doing all of these procedures. These are, we don't even consider, but I do now, since I think I'm a little bit more enlightened, having been friends with you for so many years. Now, when you cut a tooth for a filling, that's actually a surgery. And so we act like this is nothing at all, but it's a huge deal.
Absolutely.
Do you have wrap-up remarks you'd like to leave us with?
Well, in my practice, I spend a lot of time with the patient in educating them so that I'm not running around 3 or 4 rooms at once. I tend to stay with the patient during the freezing and have a chance to discuss and inform and share information. And often, if you're open to, you'll learn things from your patient. So I have that kind of a relationship with my patients so that there's more opportunity to interchange information with the patient and for them to ask questions rather than just have them come in and have their teeth worked on and leave.
Okay, that's an excellent point. Really, our healthcare providers should be our educators, and we should be a team. So thank you for those thoughts.
Thank you so much for sharing this time with us, and I really appreciate your insight. A short recap. So in the beginning, we talked about the law had changed, and that's a very important realization because up to now, the American Dental Association had blocked any attempt to write negatives and or to block the use of mercury amalgam in the teeth. They even took licenses away from dentists who refused to put amalgams in teeth. It was horrible, and it's been horrible for years. Then we spoke to a dentist, Dr. Hans Schwartz, who explained to us what he does in his practice, not utilizing amalgams for years, and how it works, and explain to us some aspects of the health of teeth. But now, and very important, I want to discuss detox, Carol. How do we get these metals out of our body? We know they're affecting us neurologically. We know they're affecting our hormones. We know they're blocking our endocrine glands. But how do we get them out? Well, up to now, we have very conscientiously attempted to use detox. And I know you have, and I have many times seen people who began to detox, and the end result is they ended up sicker than when they started. Now, how could that be? We're talking about detox. What has happened in this process of detoxing that allowed them to toxify themselves so severely? And when people feel horrible after a detox, what is happening is that they're recycling their toxins. Toxins that have accumulated over years are released and then reinfecting the body, but all at once, rather than a little bit, a little bit, a little bit. So how do we work a detox protocol piece by piece to allow a healthy detox?
I want to bring up a very, very important first step.
And just a little background, which I think is really odd, I went to the University of Wisconsin School of Pharmacy. It also housed a degree in toxicology over there. So the first rule of toxicology is remove the toxin. So before you embark on any detox for mercury, the first step would be to remove whatever mercury amalgam you have in your mouth safely, as we discussed before with Dr. Schwartz. I'd also like to put in another little caveat there. Take that mercury amalgam out of your mouth when you're healthy.
Oh, that's really important.
Yeah, if you are ill, it's not the time unless it's becoming life-threatening. So take advantage of being in relatively good health to remove that burden from your body. So talk to your dentist. Find out if they have awareness of how to remove mercury amalgam safely from your teeth. And do that in advance of you getting seriously sick.
But there's a piece of that, Carol. I think there's one little piece before that. Because we have a cycle of our organs that allow detox to happen. And it all backs up at the gut. So if we have heavy leaky gut syndrome, we're going to have problems, because no matter how careful the dentist is, he will be releasing into your system mercury, no matter how careful he is. And it used to be, and still is, that people go in, get their amalgams removed, and that afternoon they do chelation. And what chelation does, or attempts to do, is it literally grabs the circulating mercury and attempts to pull it out of the body. Now, there are two ways, actually three processes, that it has to go through to be able to be pulled out of the body. One, it is grabbed by the EDTA molecule, which is a chelator, which grabs the mercury and attempts to move it out through the kidneys. So there's a couple of things. It also goes through the liver, where it's bound and then excreted into the bowel. And so there's two things that have to happen. You have to have adequate kidney function. So there has to be lots of fluids there. But you also have to have healthy bowels, or you'll just reabsorb that mercury into your system. So
I'd like to put in a little point before we get too far away from it.
Yes.
Because you were talking about the microbial world in the gut. One of the things that we've talked about before and comes up very often is an overgrowth of yeast. And I'd like to tell you right now that yeast organisms also bind up mercury. And in a sense, they're protecting you from acute metal poisoning. It's a chronic metal poisoning with the yeast involved. And the more mercury around, the more yeast you will get. So I'd also like to caution people against using very, very aggressive anti-yeast protocols, because you'll release a bunch of mercury when you do that. On the other hand, if you are addressing the heavy metal portion of this problem with the mercury and trying to diminish your load of mercury, you can find that your gut starts to normalize and you don't have an overgrowth of yeast because it's no longer needed.
That's quite amazing. So if you're in your home and you decide to do a detox, which I must agree most of us need, where do we begin? Well, we might want to take a little time before the exact detox begins and work with our gut through using probiotics, through normalizing our bowels so that the bowels are working, and work with our kidneys Now, there are different things that are really wonderful for the kidneys, different herbals. And one of them is what they call solo dado or goldenrod. I hope I pronounced it correctly. Or goldenrod, which is lovely for helping the kidneys function. So I would do two things. I would get a liver detox protocol. I would work with probiotics on my bowel, which already begins that detox process, and I would make sure my kidneys are functioning and I had enough fluids. Now, once we are there, there are some very powerful things that you might want to add to your detox. It can be vegetable. It can be broth. I love broth. I love organic chicken bones or turkey bones, and I make very powerful broths. But added to that, I like a few things. One, I like to take chlorella pills. Although they're not very strong, they're very supportive in drawing toxins out of your body. But you have to look at the pills that you're getting and make sure you're getting pills that have been tested for heavy metals, because chlorella is such a powerful chelator that it could be drawing heavy metals into itself in the lakes in which they are grown.
You can do very aggressive chelating programs, or you can do less aggressive. And if you've gotten your amalgams out and you're not really compromised and just want to work on this on your own, I have a couple suggestions. One is, a very few people realize that iodine is a mercury chelator. And I found this in a pharmacopoeia that was over 100 years old.
Wow.
So it's amazing that we've had this knowledge for all these years, and we don't really use it. So we've become strong proponents of iodine on this show for various reasons, but we don't usually talk about its powerful effect on chelating metals. Another chelator that doesn't really come to mind right at the top of the bundle, but is going to work slowly and steadily, is our good old friend vitamin C. So you can, every time you take vitamin C, you are slowly and gradually working on your heavy metal burden. Another third thing to be absolutely conscious of is those heavy metals are sitting in receptors that are really designed for essential minerals. So it's important that when you are trying to do any kind of chelating, that you have plenty of minerals to pop into the receptors available to do the good work they're supposed to be doing. And that, if you keep up your mineral status, and we've talked about things like juicing and, of course, the bone broth, these things are wonderful for the trace minerals that you're getting in there. That should be on board, too, while you're trying to do any sort of detoxification.
I like a cocktail of binders for the intestines, because we know that we're dumping into the intestines. So I like chlorella, as I said. I like charcoal. And charcoal gets almost all other mycotoxins except for an aflatoxin. It binds them and allows your body to push them out. And clay, which binds aflatoxins, but none of the other mycotoxins. So you mix the three together, the chlorella, the charcoal, and the clay, and you have this incredible intestinal cleanser. But your bowels have to be moving. And you're going to be able to get almost all of those toxins out of your body. You know, detoxing involves moving toxins out of the cell, not just out of the bowels. and out of the blood, and squeezing the toxins out of your cell and into your blood circulation, and then filtering out the metals through your kidney, your liver, and your GI tract. But you begin by that squeezing of the toxins out of the cell. And what does that? Glutathione. Glutathione is very effective in literally pulling heavy metals out of the cell and moving them into the bloodstream in conjunction with lipoic acid, but not S-lipoic acid, R-lipoic acid. And it can be very effective. So we're looking at the bowel, and we have looked at the bowel in terms of what helps move things out of the bowel. Then we want to look at the kidneys. What supports the kidneys? And there are a few very well-known herbs that support the kidneys. One is dandelion. One is milk thistle, which supports the liver and the kidneys. Another is our bitters, like gentian, and then mirth. And for added kidney support, I always like cranberry. Cranberry is really effective. Solidago, or as we know it, goldenrod, and corn silk. Those little hairs on the inside of the corn, which our mothers used to boil and drink to get good, strong fingernails and get beautiful hair. So those are general kidney and liver support herbs that are very important.
That last contains silica.
Yes.
Which is also a great chelator and helps pull out the metals. I want to just put in, before we get too far along, one more simple detox mechanism. That's through your sweat.
Oh, yes.
So, there's two things that will come out through your sweat that are hard to get out of your body in other ways, and that's heavy metals and chemicals. And so a regular sauna protocol, with an infrared sauna or even the regular sauna, will help you discharge some of those heavy metals. Or sweating, just sweating. Work hard and sweat.
That's a little harder. Last night I was in an infrared sauna, and I stayed in so long, I was just dripping, came out, showered, lay on my bed, and passed out into one of the deepest sleeps I've had in a long time. It was such a beautiful sensation to have been heated up and then go into sleep. So when we're detoxing, we really want to make sure our detox filters are working. And our detox filters and our bowels, our liver, and particularly our kidneys. But you said something else that I hadn't really had on my list, because I have a list in front of me that I've been working off of, I put together and been working, is the skin. There's a book by Dr. Billy Akpinar, and it's called Sweat, No Sweat, K-N-O-W, Sweat. Uh-huh. And it's an amazing book on the function of sweat and how it works to allow such a powerful detoxing and cleansing to take place. You know, people who are very low adrenal, and I know I used to be, do not sweat. And they just don't sweat. I used to go to the gym and work and work and work, and I used to wear a light gray t-shirt. on purpose, so I could see the sweat under my arms and on my chest, you know, that circle. I never, no matter what I did or how hard I worked out, I never had those sweat circles.
That's an important thing.
It's very important.
Many, many people just tell me they don't sweat. And you will sweat if you keep on trying. Mm-hmm. One of the things that does become apparent if you do sauna regularly and you don't sweat, and I had that problem particularly with the regular saunas. I would just go in there and burn up and no sweat. When I switched to using infrared, the sweating was a little easier, and now I will sweat just fine. So it's a can be a progression. So if you say you can't sweat or don't sweat, don't panic. It's something you can develop, and it just takes a little work.
Yeah, it took time even with the infrared for me to start sweating.
Mm-hmm.
It took multiple applications before I would get hot, but I wouldn't sweat. And mm-hmm. now I'm sweating. I don't want to talk about it. Sweating a whole large amount. But, you know, many of my patients come in and they're not well. And they take NAC and they say they're getting glutathione and all the glutathione they need. But one thing that this doctor, Chris Shade, states is that when you're very inflamed and you're not well, you're not able to convert the NAC in the cell to the glutathione, N-acetylcysteine. Those are the molecules that make the glutathione. And glutathione is very tricky. It's hard to get it into you. It's broken down by the stomach, so they make it liposomal, and they say that it's highly absorbed, but yet they're really not able to prove that well. They do it IV, but that's very difficult for most people to get. Now they're doing it in other forms, but what happens is, so there was a quick and easy, down and dirty way to get glutathione, and that was to take NAC, N-acetylcysteine, and you would then, at least it was stated, get the benefits of glutathione. But what has happened, and what is happening, is that so many of us are so inflamed and so toxic that when we take NAC, we're not converting it and we're not able to. So we're still deficient in glutathione. And I don't know, we didn't say today, we've said many times before, but glutathione is your number one body's antioxidant, with 1,000 times more antioxidant power than vitamin C. As a matter of fact, the ability to convert and utilize vitamin C is based to some degree on glutathione. So glutathione is very important for us to get, and it's a sulfur amino acid.
Okay, so let's take a few minutes to recap. We talked about reducing or removing the source of the toxin, for sure. We talked about improving your gut health. This is a seat of where you can do detoxification. We talked about absorbance to help mop up the metals and other things like mycotoxins from mold. We talked about some herbs that can strengthen your liver and kidneys. We talked about easy gradual detoxes with things like vitamin C, iodine, trace minerals. And then we spent some time talking about saunas, sweat your metals away. What did I miss, Corinne?
Not much, my darling. Not much. So next week, I'd like to define and give an outline of detox protocols, a couple of them that we've seen very effective and very healthful. How about that, Carol?
Sounds interesting.
I think it could be. I think it could be very interesting because I know our listeners are very willing and excited about detox. So I want to thank you for spending this time with us. It's fun, always fun. And thank you, Carol. I always learn. You always learn. It's always wonderful to share this time with you and with our listeners. So
don't, Don't forget our Facebook page, Take Charge of Your Health with Corinne and Carol. Please visit us there.
We have some questions. We're doing tremendous work on our Facebook and on our websites. So in a little bit, we're going to announce it, and then we're going to ask you to go on. And we'd love your opinion, what you think, and any type of questions and or any topics that you want to hear. Send them to us and let's see what we can do. We listen. We answer. Bye-bye. Thank you. Be healthy. Be healthy. Bye.
Bye.
So we'll be back next week. Thank you again. Bye-bye.
Bye.
In conclusion, I'd like to say, remember, this information is not an attempt to diagnose or a substitute for treatment. As always, we urge you to take this and all other information we share with you up with your healthcare practitioner. Clearly, this comes under the category of taking charge of your health. You can hear this program in its entirety on my Facebook, Corinne Fornari, RPA, CCN, or on Take Charge of Your Health Facebook page, Take Charge of Your Health. My website is fornarihealth.com, and my office number is 212-219-0700. That's 212-219-0700. And I know many of you noticed that beautiful music, a big change. My brother's group wrote it for me, Left Hook from Redding, California. Their website is Redding Left Hook. Really special. Thank you so much for spending this time with us, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.